in the Wyndham Lewis book, Hitler by Wyndham Lewis, published by Chatto and Windus in London in 1931. We're doing part three, Race and Class. And we did many class wars in quotes, and then The Art of Being Ruled in quotes. And now we're going to the third and last part, titled One Advantage in Race Notion, race in quotes. One Advantage in Race Notion. And this is short, few pages, and we go on to the next section on the youth movement. So he says, what the National Socialist is in reality attempting to do is to put race in the place of class. He says that the fact that a man is a sorter at the post office or a metal worker is not of such importance as that he is German or English, German or French or Chinese. Take a Chinese metal worker and a German metal worker, for instance. The fact that both were metal workers would not be so important as that the essential nature of one came out of all the past of China and the essential nature of the other out of all the past of the white northern races. Does the notion of race supply as workable an ideology as that of class? It is impossible to answer that directly. If you make a fuss about the Celts, then it may be more attractive to the Irish metal worker to regard himself as a Celt than as a metal worker. But at least it may be conceded that race is a more inclusive thing than class. Once a Celt, always a Celt, whatever a Celt may be. But the metal worker may be a bookies clerk tomorrow, and later on might take to the sea. How much of what we call our personality comes to us from the countless people who have contributed to the production of us, us in quotes? That's a question. How much of what we call our personality comes to us from the countless people who have contributed to the production of us? Is it, one, possible, two, desirable, that this past should be wiped out? I got to move the phone just a second. So he says, is it possible, desirable, that this past should be wiped out? I do not think we really have any choice in the matter. However, the class doctrinaire has no greater enemy than race, and it is natural, therefore, that he should seek every opportunity of belittling race. It is also natural that the National Socialist persuaded that the class war propaganda is one of the main factors in the present disintegration, for it sets friend against friend. That's why they should insist upon race. Let me read that again. It is also natural that the National Socialist persuaded that the class war propaganda is one of the main factors in the present disintegration, for it sets friend against friend, should insist upon race. And in Germany he has done that to some purpose. In brackets, here it is only the stupidest of the stupid that would respond to anything of that sort. End of bracket. The class doctrine, as opposed to the race doctrine, demands a clean slate. Everything must be wiped off slick, a sort of colorless, featureless automaton, temporarily two-dimensional, is what is required by the really fanatical Marxist autocrat. Nothing but a mind without backgrounds, without any spiritual depth. Nothing but a mind without backgrounds, without any spiritual depth, a flat mirror for propaganda. A parrot soul to give back the catchwords, an ego without reflection, in a word, a sort of Peter Pan machine. The adult child will be tolerated. So nothing but a mind without backgrounds, without any spiritual depth, a flat mirror for propaganda, a parrot soul to give back the catchwords, an ego without reflection, in a word, a sort of Peter Pan machine. The adult child will be tolerated. The drawbacks, or rather the problems connected with the realization of the race doctrine, I have dealt with in a section of this essay entitled, quote, All That Is Not Race Is Dross, unquote. The extreme interpretation of the race doctrine would be liable to leave you with a romantic snob on your hands. The extreme interpretation of the class doctrine with a simple robot. What I think it is safe to affirm is that race, used as a propagandist engine, must tend to simplify and to concentrate. It promises political unity at all events. It would, if followed out, draw people together rather than thrust them apart, at least the people of the same race. Thus it would secure greater social efficiency. To demonstrate this, it is only necessary to point to the condition of the wife and husband under a regime ideologically based upon race. as opposed to the same couple under a regime based on class. In brackets, sex, of course, being one of the most important classes of all, and bracketed there. It must, however, be absolutely understood that there is no question of the Anglo-Saxon ever emulating this racialism of the Germans. There is no occasion to go into the reasons for this. It is quite certain that it could not possibly happen. But class, for that matter, except the traditional upper and lower class, is also not such a great success in England. That is no reason at all, however, why we should laugh at other people's ways of conducting their affairs or not make the effort to fathom what they are driving at. There is nothing inherently ridiculous in race. It is simply a thing the Englishman takes no interest in. It is simply a thing the Englishman takes no interest in, and that the American is bound to disregard in the middle of the American melting pot. So that's the end of the section on one advantage in race notion. Anybody have any comments?
I found it interesting. He was describing the ego without reflection. So it's like, would it be mind control, or to manipulate people to be more reactive regarding race?
Yeah, the class doctrine demands a clean slate. Everything must be wiped off slick. A sort of colorless, featureless automaton, temporarily two-dimensional, is what's required by the really fanatical Marxist autocrat. Nothing but a mind, this is what's tolerated. Nothing but a mind without backgrounds, without any spiritual depth, a flat mirror for propaganda, a parrot soul to give back the catchwords, an ego without reflection, in a word, a sort of Peter Pan machine, the adult child. Nothing but those things will be tolerated. So, I don't think that's ionic. Is nothing but a mind without backgrounds, without any spiritual depth, a flat mirror for propaganda, a parrot soul to give back the catchwords, an ego without reflection. In a word, a sort of Peter Pan machine. The adult child will be tolerated. So that's pretty non-ionic, I think.
Yeah.
It could be. If you're ascended, you could be giving back words to your fellow little men. Catchwords. You might appear to be empty on purpose. So he didn't want to engage with the little men too much. But you weren't a superficial, surface flat mirror for propaganda. So, anybody have anything to say? No? Was that racist? Was he talking racism there? He's saying
not,
that.
Not really. I mean, I didn't pick it up as racist. He's just objectively describing how
race would unite the society more
right.
than the class.
Yes.
And class would be getting weaker because people could do many more jobs, move around, more mobility was coming.
It sounds like genocide. Are you guys reading the Hitler book?
Yes.
Okay.
Where do you get the genocide?
Oh, kind of taking away everything but the ego, taking away any kind of discrepancy. But I just came in,
that.
So
he's
I didn't hear anything
about
the quote. Okay.
No, okay, you don't know. He's talking about race is a better classification, according to the German Nazis, than class. You include more if you include race. Now, they didn't want to include everybody, so they make this category of race, which apparently was a concept invented in the 19th century or so. So this is the Nazis trying to redo and improve the 19th century concept of race. Okay?
Yes.
All in, all good?
All in, all good.
Let's go. And that was called One Advantage in Race Notion. So he dared to lay out an advantage, one aspect in politics. Now, we are going to, let's see. This is part four, called Youth Movement, that's in quotes, becomes Hitler Movement, and that's in quotes. So I'm going to mute everybody just so we get no interruptions.
All participants are now muted.
If I stop and there's a gap, that means the phone died and I had to get the other phone. Youth Movement becomes Hitler Movement. Part one. The German Youth Movement becomes the Hitler Movement. Let's see, is that the only title? Yes, so it's part four of the book, and it's made up of one part. The human model for a thoroughgoing Klassenmensch, or class person, would be, so I remarked in the last chapter, a featureless infantile robot, a mechanical infant robot without any mental or physical background at all. That is a standardized Peter Pan who learns nothing and forgets everything, a phonograph for the convenient parrot cries of the hour. The rather childlike and slavish Russian nature may be purveying millions of such bearded, infantile, ecstatic Peter Pan parrots at this moment, I do not know, but that at all events is the ideal. It must be the ultimate result, if it has not already happened. In this connection, the melting of the Jugendbewegung, or youth movement, into the Hitlerbewegung is of considerable interest. And of course, youth movement has come to signify age war, that is, a child and parent war. In mild and pretty forms, we are quite familiar with that war here, too. The newspapers are as full of age war articles and youth at the helm propaganda as they have ever been of sex war articles. And the particular class war based upon the youth mysticism has at once the most sinister and ridiculous results. 10 years ago, it popped a herd of old women into short, knee-high showgirl skirts. It humbugs and afterwards distresses and unsettles a great number of politically oversimple adolescent persons. The fulsome flattery is taken au pied de la lettre. And then, as with other political flatteries, nothing happens, and youth grows restless and sad. The meaning of the youth propaganda is patent enough. In big business, fewer and fewer individuals are indispensable. Less and less responsibility is shared by any given member of the more and more mechanical staff of underlings. A machine could usually do as well or better all the work that any average civil servant or big business office employee spends his life at. The postage stamp machine does better and quicker what the employee behind the post office counter is doing half the time. The adding machine does more efficiently the work of a bank clerk, etc., etc. End of bracket. Under these rapidly changing conditions of mechanized business, the idea that seniority should spell higher wages is obsolete. The idea that seniority, in quotes, should spell higher wages is obsolete. Because a man is 40, he should logically have less, not more. This does not apply to many occupations where experience or personal initiative still counts. But it must apply to all the great impersonal services, the offices of trust, corporations, and government services. In them, the man of 40 should have less, not more, than at 20, because he is an adding machine, or a stamp machine, or a sorting machine that is wearing out. The youth of 20 doesn't exactly... The youth of 20 does exactly what he does, and he is fresher. Under these circumstances, the nonsense about experience, in quotes, seniority, in quotes, and all the things that were realities prior to the machine age, has to be knocked on the head. The newspapers are the property of the big business barons. They are the propaganda department, as it were. Their debonair gossip columns, even, with their disarming chatterboxing, are put to the most serious political uses, all mixed up, of course, with what frocks Miss Chatterbox saw at the wedding of the Honorable Julius so-and-so. What, in fact, the age war or youth propaganda articles are saying is just what I've said above. They're saying, quote, you old bald adding machine of 40-odd, Don't you come round and ask me for a raise next week. There's many a good, strong youth of 18 will be only too glad to do your work. I'll give the job to him for 2 pins. How I love youth. I'd like to see it at the helm, straight I would. As to you, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Another word from you about higher wages, and out you go, on the dole. See? Well, let's just pause for a minute there. That's pretty funny. Unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
It's what the Tim Farrell skit I was telling you about. You get out was the scene in every movie. That's pretty perfect. And then you come here, and the guy is saying, another word from you about higher wages, and out you go on the dole.
Common theme.
So, yeah, so let's see. I did that, and now we must finish this section on Hitler, the German youth movement becomes the Hitler movement. Now he's, well, what's he, has he said what he's going to do here? He's going to separate people by race. Still allow them to be feminists and whatever that they want to promote. He's not knocking that. So he says, the fact is generally, so this insulting paragraph from the movie, what is it called? Slim Pickings or something? Anybody? Oh. And you know, I didn't even mute you, and you still didn't say anything. But I will mute you now.
All participants are now muted.
So what was I saying about the something? Anybody? Let me unmute there.
All participants are now unmuted.
It was right before the guy asked, he told that if you ask for a higher wage, you're out. That's what was less.
Right.
It's
but what, has anybody contributed any ideas to interpret this text? No. Nobody's contributed anything.
Well, I said I thought of genocide earlier, and directly you're telling me here it's not that at all. It's you keep your whatever, but you're going here. Is it more of like a segregation? Or desegregation? No, this is confusing.
It looks like, for me, it looks like they're just outlining that the youth are more employable and useful, and they can hire them for a lesser wage. That's what I heard. And that's when the point came up that the person asked for a higher wage, they're out of there because they're lining up how useful the youth can be in the movement.
You have a problem with that, Sarah?
No, not at all. I just was wondering if we had gotten to the why youth are more employable, and is that because they have less impressions?
Right. Okay, let me continue. On the dole, see? The fact that it's generally a pretty aged ruffian who is saying this or who is at the bottom of this maneuver is neither here nor there. That makes it all the better fun. We all know today why feminism came off. In brackets, I am not now discussing the rights or wrongs of feminism. I'm a feminist, of course. I'm only discussing its great backing and its complete success. End of bracket. Women swarmed into the big business offices, shops, civil services. They did the very simple mechanical work such occupations entail just as well as the men they displaced. And they got less pay. That's in italics. In England and America, this same process is occurring with the youth movement. Age war lever. I'll do it again. In England and America, this same process is occurring with the youth movement or age war lever. The newspapers, in other words, the propaganda department of the great British interests, have got busy everywhere. And there's little doubt that before long, men's and women's wages will be on a diminishing scale over, say, 28 years old. Diminishing scale over, say, somebody 28 years old. At 40, it will be the dole. For if man is to be used wholly as a machine, why is it possible to go on treating him as if he were something else? His immortal soul is all very well. That's in quotes, immortal soul. His immortal soul is all very well, but we none of us believe much in that, do we? Read that again. His immortal soul is all very well, but we none of us believe much in that, do we, at this time of the day? Here's a cutting or clipping from the Daily Telegraph, May 28, 1929. Homes for the aged at 50 is, I think, a euphemism, a breaking it gently. For having regard to what machines can do and the daily output of new labor-saving appliances and consequent huge unemployment, there is no reason to suppose that a man's effective working life can last longer than 15 years. 20 years old to 35, say, under the present capitalist system. However, there is the rather out-of-date Daily Telegraph statement. And he goes on to say, too old at 50 in the United States, subtitled super efficiency victims, and then an appeal for pensions. So he starts off, Winnemlu starts off quoting Mr. Hamilton Fish, a politician at the time. America is the richest country in the world, unquote, said Representative Hamilton Fish in the House of Representatives today. Quote, but our wage earners are left alone to worry and suffer the humiliation of poverty in their declining years, unquote. Mr. Fish urged that the time had arrived when the United States, quote, shall cease playing the ostrich act and attempt to solve the serious problem of old age dependency, unquote. He proposes a special committee. So he, who's he?
The American, maybe?
The American what?
Just the American in general. Isn't that what the subject of the sentence before was?
Yeah, it could. It could be that. Yeah. I forgot to mute everybody. Mute.
All participants are now muted.
So he proposes a special committee. So this would be Hamilton Fish. Mr. Fish proposes a special committee of five members to be appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, quote, to inquire into old age pensions and study modern methods by which practically all advanced nations of the world afford constructive relief to the worthy aged poor. American wage earners of today, he said, are thrown out on the industrial scrap heap at middle age due to high pressure and due to the super efficiency methods of industrial plants, and the man or woman at 50 is unable to keep pace with younger workers. Let me read that again. American wage earners of today, he said, are thrown out on the industrial scrap heap of middle age due to high pressure and to the super efficiency methods of industrial plants, and the man or woman at 50 is unable to keep pace with younger workers. Let me unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
It's quite kind of interesting that this section, he seems to be discussing more of America than Germany, and as
right.
far as the wages and talking about middle age, so he seems to be talking about the employment structure in America more so than Germany. It's pretty interesting to see where he's going with this.
Yeah.
And what year was this written?
1931.
Well, that's
probably written
late.
Yeah, it was probably written, you know, late 30, early 31. Right in the middle of the Depression, the worst part of the Depression. A year after the, well, 6 months after the crash in October.
I also heard his media ecology reference about machines, about treating a man as a machine. Earlier when you first started that
you mean just
flag.
Now tonight
yeah earlier, yeah. Just the first few sentences he was talked. I didn't get the full reference, but he was mentioned about treating a man like a machine.
Looking through it. Okay, so nobody has anything to say. Let's carry on. How far did I get? I was reading that article. Too old at 50 in the USA. Super efficiency victims. An appeal for pensions. So I got as far as... All right, so I'll mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
So the article, maybe I read some of this, do this again. I don't remember reading much of this. America is the richest country in the world, said Representative Hamilton Fish in the House of Representatives today. But our wage earners are left alone to worry and suffer the humiliation of poverty in their declining years. Mr. Fish urged that the time had arrived when the United States, quote, shall cease playing the ostrich act and attempt to solve the serious problem of old age dependency, unquote. How far did I read? Why did I stop? Let me go back and check. I did the feminism thing, right? Unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
And they got less pay. Is there some reason we stopped there?
I don't remember.
Did I say for if man is to be used wholly as a machine, why is it possible to go on treating him as if he were something else? Yeah, I said that. His immortal soul is all very well, but we none of us believe much in that, do we, at this time of the day? That sounds like about where I faded out. Yes. I'm going to read this last paragraph. So we're going to go back a bit here. In England and America, the same process is occurring with the youth movement age war lever. The newspapers, in other words, the propaganda department of the great business interests, have got busy everywhere. And there's little doubt that before long, men's and women's wages will be on a diminishing scale over, say, 28 years old. At 40, it will be the dole. For if man is to be used wholly as a machine, why is it possible to go on treating him as if he were something else? His immortal soul is all very well, but we none of us believe much in that, do we, at this time of the day? Here is a cutting from the Daily Telegraph, May 28, 1929. Homes for the aged at 50 is, I think, a euphemism. Homes for the aged at 50 is, I think, a euphemism. Breaking it gently. For having regard to what machines can do and the daily output of new labor-saving appliances and consequent huge unemployment, there is no reason to suppose that a man's effective working life can last longer than 15 years under the present capitalist system. 20 years old to 35, say. So I'll read that again. Homes for the aged at 50 is, I think, a euphemism, a breaking it gently. For having regard to what machines can do and the daily output of new labor-saving appliances and consequent huge unemployment, there is no reason to suppose that a man's effective working life can last longer than 15 years, 20 years old to 35, say, under the present capitalist system. However, here's the rather out-of-date Telegraph statement. I remember reading this. Uh, but not this part. Okay. Too old at 50 in the USA, super efficiency victims, an appeal for pensions. Quote, America is the richest country in the world, said Representative Hamilton Fish in the House of Representatives today. But our wage earners are left alone to worry and suffer the humiliation of poverty in their declining years, unquote. Mr. Fish urged that the time had arrived when the United States shall cease playing the ostrich act and attempt to solve the serious problem of old age dependency. He proposed a special committee of 5 members to be appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives to inquire into old age pensions and study modern methods by which practically all advanced nations of the world afford constructive relief to the worthy aged poor. American wage earners of today, he said, are thrown out on the industrial scrap heap at middle age due to high pressure and to the super efficiency methods of industrial plants, and the man or woman of 50 is unable to keep pace with younger workers. Fish estimates that millions of American men and women with families to support are totally unable to save funds for old age, and declares the problem can only be solved by sound, economical, constructive legislation. Several state legislatures, including New York, are now inquiring on similar lines. In a recent message to the legislature, the governor of the state of New York condemned the present method of dealing with the aged by means of almshouses as antiquated, inefficient, expensive, and demoralizing. Let me read that again. In a recent message to the legislature, the governor of the state of New York condemned the present method of dealing with the aged by means of almshouses as antiquated, inefficient, expensive, and demoralizing. In the above passage, people are, I think, being let down a little too gently, for it's not at all likely that the employer of the future, whether that be an autocratic communist state or present capitalism, is going to wait till a person is 50 to dismiss him. Nor is it likely that the machine soul of either communism or capitalism is going to support an obsolete and useless human mind, human machine, in comfort and plenty up to a ripe old age. Okay. Anybody have a comment on that so far?
No.
The age war. Okay.
All participants are now muted.
Every man, I'm sure, reading all that I have been saying above, would consider it a little joke of mine, a rather ferocious little joke, perhaps in bad taste somewhat, but still a harmless joke. But then he considers the articles he reads in the newspaper's jokes as well. Is not the newspaper his newspaper? And he quotes my, quote, morning paper, unquote. The journalist is his buffoon. The reporter, or our special correspondent, is the fellow who reports to him The reporter, or our special correspondent, is the fellow who reports to him what is going on in the world. Reading it again. The journalist is his buffoon. The reporter, or our special correspondent, is the fellow who reports to him what is going on in the world. And my word, doesn't he just see to it that those reports are correct to the letter? Again, Mr. Everyman, or l'homme moyen sensuel, the average sensual man, is a sentimentalist, and so he thinks everybody else is. About age, his age, he is very sentimental and superstitious. And in any attempt to convey to him the inner meaning of this particular class war, there lies a difficulty. To make him sure that the sentimental angle is not the angle of everybody is none too easy. His average sensuality furnishes him with little glamorous and softnesses that are far from being shared by the very hard-headed. And oh yes, hard-hearted big business elders, there's your elders, who are occupied, not with the humdrum squalor of the average suburban life, but with somewhat more complicated considerations and more extended horizons, temporal and other. There is no humbug, so this is in brackets. There is no humbug so sedulously propagated as that regarding the stupidity of the business magnate. Stupidity in italics. It is obvious why it is to that gentleman's advantage to have you believe that he is stupid. Such stupid business magnates, such stupid business magnates do exist, no doubt. But there are, but too plainly, many who are not stupid at all. Is perhaps safer not to believe too implicitly in this much-advertised stupidity. I only throw out this suggestion. You are perfectly at liberty to disregard my caution, he says to his brother. Then Lewis says, to run over now. Is this Lewis talking to it? He mentioned a brother. I think he did. Oh, I'm muted.
All participants are now unmuted.
No, it's the first time I heard a brother.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm thinking. I don't think Lewis had a brother. Okay.
All participants are now muted.
To run over now what I have been saying, being a feminist, I believe that women should have freedom so long as it is not destructive of non-feminine freedom. I like the Negro and think he should not be discriminated against. Again, men and women are usually more interesting at 20 than at 40. But all that has nothing to do with what I've been describing, and in no way impinges upon the accuracy of my analysis. A sex war, an age war, a color line war are all equally promoted by big business to cheapen labor and to enslave men more and more. I do not like the present capitalist system. It seems to me to be a very bad system indeed. I believe that it brings into anything it touches something of destructive and evil. So I think we should learn to discriminate between some given humanitarian truth upon the one hand and that truth as destructively presented to us, as is generally the case, by the propaganda department of the great financial interest, namely the newspapers or in books, films, etc., upon the other. Read that again. So I think we should learn to discriminate between some given humanitarian truth upon the one hand and that truth as destructively presented to us, as is generally the case, by the propaganda department of the great financial interest upon the other. Now, Germany is the place where the youth movement started, and today what the Angriff asserts is largely the truth, namely that the youth movement has become the Hitler movement. In the German supplement to the Times in 1929, there was an interesting article upon German conditions today. The writer of that article regretfully confessed that the youth movement was over. It had broken up, he said, into a series of separate political movements attached to the various contending political parties. Okay, so where were we at? I get it. Now, Germany is the place where the youth movement started, and today what the Angriff asserts is largely the truth, namely that the youth movement has become the Hitler movement. In the German supplement to the Times in 1929, there was an interesting article upon German conditions today. The writer of that article regretfully confessed that the youth movement was over. It had broken up, he said, into a series of separate political movements attached to the various contending political parties. In italics, youth, in quotes, had become political. The Hitler movement is a movement of young men and women. The Berlin leader of the Nazis, for instance, Dr. Goebbels, is 34, and the rank and file of the movement show a preponderance of young men and young women. Half at least of the academic youth of Germany are supporters of Hitler. There are great numbers of young workmen in the movement, just as was the case with the fascist movement at the start. Now, what is very peculiar is that when a leader like Hitler or Mussolini secures the support of the youth of the country, the press at once begins describing this misguided youth as political cannon fodder. The fascists or the National Socialists are making use of youth for their own disgusting political ends. Were the same bodies of young men and young women following the red banner, they would look on very kindly and sigh, boys will be boys, unquote. If these youngsters were attending social democratic youth at the helm rallies, they would be delighted. I am not an advocate of Hitlerism, nor yet of Italian fascism. But what is certain is that if you want to see youth at work and in its element, with all its characteristic passion and idealism, you cannot do better than go to the meetings of the Hitlerists. There, youth at the helm is not a phrase, but a fact, and youth with its eyes wide open. But that is not at all what is expected of youth by the golden-tongued, insinuating youth fans. No, youth has become so political, they sigh, as though youth, in their sense, had ever been anything else but political. Youth mysticism is purely political in origin. Reference the youth mysticism in fascist Italy or Russia. It will sound very strange to most English ears, I know. But in fact, young Woodley is fundamentally just as political. So that seems to be some show, young Woodley. Okay. It will sound very strange to most English ears, I know. But in fact, young Woodley is fundamentally just as political in its essential impulse as a speech by Winston Churchill. Art, it is not, but it may be quite good politics. From being a romantic fact, youth has become a political fact. People only complain about this if they do not like the brand of politics involved. End of that section, which is called The German Youth Movement Becomes the Hitler Movement. There's a picture here. Still looking for it. Here it is. Youth in the Reichstag Gallery. So they show these young people sitting there. Some look bored. Some are looking away. They all look very serious. Wish you could see it. So the next section is called, and it's part five, all that is not race in this world is dross, or dross. Let me just see if anybody's got a reaction to...
All participants are now unmuted.
Bit. Anybody have a comment on that?
I found his, there was a reference of use of sex, age, and race as cheap labor, and also mm-hmm. that the youth movement was political. It's complete observation of what was taking place like at the time. You can see parallels of what's going on now in the, in various segments of society as far as how that's manipulated as far as the cheap labor.
So Lewis is saying it's a manipulation.
That's what I gather.
Yeah.
But he's saying the youth movement is political. And before that, he made some references that he put his own personal view that women should have freedom, blacks should do their thing, whatever. But then he lays out that sex, age, and race is used for cheap labor.
Right.
And that the youth movement is a political motivation.
Hmm. He says, I am not an advocate of Hitlerism, nor yet of Italian fascism. But what is certain is that if you want to see youth at work and in its element, with all its characteristic passion and idealism, you cannot do better than go to the meetings of the Hitlerists. Okay, part five. All that is not race in this world is drugs. And we'll mute. There is Eliza came in, Ginny came in, and maybe Jean. Did you guys want to say anything, or did you just come in?
This is Ginny.
Yes. How are you doing?
Good. I wanted to say that that is something that has happened before also, too, with the Alabama, the Birmingham March on the drug counter, you know, when the young people organized themselves at Fisk University for nonviolent protesting, that was actually organized by a gentleman by the name of Jim Lawler, who was very committed to instilling nonviolent principles into black youth so that they could start a revolution. And then it created a platform for action that Martin Luther King just kind of stepped onto. It's almost like an Escher where the whole scene was extended, and he just stepped into a role. And
right.
It sounds to me like that's what's being said about this Hitler thing. So, you know, youth are being catalyzed for action, and then somebody actually can come in and, you know, be the leader of that action, even though it doesn't necessarily take the young people where they want to go. They just want something to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But isn't Hitler, he's already leading them. He's drawing attention to them.
Jim Lawler was already... Jim Lawler was also doing the same thing. He was leading them, and he was very much inspiring them through the principles of Gandhi. He went to study with Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, they were engaged, and they knew in part what they were getting into, but they didn't know the full of what they were getting into. And, you know, I mean, my dad says that because my dad spent a lot of time studying Hitler for some reason, he went to school in Heidelberg, and he was very involved in post-World War II reconstruction because of my grandfather's role in the military. And anyway...
You were German?
What?
You're German?
Well, I personally am... Gunther, yes.
yeah, Gunther, yeah, that's right.
yeah, but we weren't born in Germany, and my dad wasn't born in Germany, but my father's father was stationed in Germany as a senior supply officer as part of the reconstruction of those areas. And so my dad went to... So he got really involved in trying to understand the dynamics of the war and how it all jumped off. So he became quite a Hitler scholar, and he would tell me repeatedly that Hitler did have a very good economic plan. I mean, his plan for the economy of Germany was very solid, and that's what the young people were wanting. They wanted the economic future. They wanted to be secure. And so, you know, that's how they kind of got into that whole, how they were able to get catalyzed by him. And then, of course, it went way south. But
okay,
that's
so,
why I think it's so important on the What You Show, Bob. The point I'm making is here we have the Hitler Youth Movement, then we have the Black Movement, and now we have the Bob Movement. And I just think it's important for you to not only have your platform and have your theorizing, catalyzing information, but then you also have to have a viable economic plan, Bob. What's your economic plan?
Oh, I got one. I just want to acknowledge my predecessor. I guess I'm funnier. Who prepared the ground? Who was my Jim Lawler? It was Matthew Hurtado, who became a workshop builder last fall for a couple of weeks, right? He started off building and spreading the Ionic wisdom as a potential workshop guy.
Yeah,
and,
right.
So I stepped in to the momentum created.
No, you're stepping into the momentum that McLuhan created. Don't associate yourself with Matthew.
Well,
God, please.
That was a joke. Okay, so I'm continuing the movement that McLuhan was part of, and Joyce before him, and who could be before it, and Mr. Macaulay in England, and then maybe Lord Byron, and then back to Alexander Pope and Jonathan Swift, and then back to John Dryden, then Shakespeare, St. Thomas Aquinas, a couple of those weird guys about 500 A.D., and then Joseph. I wasn't Jesus. I was the guy behind the scenes funding it, that Joseph guy that ended up going to Ireland. You ever hear about him?
Yes, of course. That's right. Yeah, that's the rich young ruler. Uh-huh, Joseph of Arimathea.
Right, and then going back to... Pharaoh, and then Menippus, 220 BC, Menippus, and then Alexander, some right-hand man of Alexander, and keep going back till we get to that weird, mysterious guy. The brother-in-law. No, father-in-law. No, brother-in-law. No, father-in-law. I don't know what the hell he was, but he was hanging around Moses, and he had Moses by the balls. Well, Moses worked his ass off for this. Ophanel Hobab. What a name.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. Ophanel Hobab. That's right. Good old Ophanel.
Yeah, that's the guy
that's right.
who started. We have to give him the kudos. He started from the original ambivalence. He wouldn't even say whether he was a man or a woman or a dog or a horse. And they couldn't even tell who he was connected to legally. Ah, praise Ophanel, the original Manipian.
There you go. Very good.
Netred manager. Yeah, so now back to this thing. So your father, just 20 years old, happened to be in Germany in 45, 46, so he went to Heidelberg. He wasn't. No other schooling before that. The rest was in the United States, right?
Right. His schooling was in the U.S. until he went to all 4 years of high school. I think, yeah. Well, he was born in, it would have been a little later, like 48, I think. Well, wait a minute. Let's see. Yeah, right around 45, 46. Yep, that's right.
What, those he was going times. To college or high school?
No, high school.
Oh, okay.
In Heidelberg, yes.
So did he have to learn speaking German?
Yes, he sure did, and he spoke fluent German.
Hmm. Okay, so your point is, you're pointing out how Martin Luther King was set up by Lawler, and Lawler is happening in the mid-50s?
No, that's the 60s. That's the march on, you know, the Birmingham Well, Lawler was at Fisk University as a professor, and he studied under Mahatma Gandhi, and he was he was the one who decided that nonviolent resistance was the way. And so he organized, he was the organizer of the Birmingham Soda Shop Demand for Service that kicked off the whole scene. And he organized those kids in the basement of Fisk University for many, many, many months before they actually went into Birmingham to the soda counter.
Right.
Which
Is he African American?
Yes, Jim Lawler. You know what? I don't know, to tell you the truth. Now that I think, I think he had to have been. Yeah, the Birmingham campaign in 1963. Let's see if it mentions Jim Lawler.
Martin Luther King has his big speech in August 63. I think the bombings happened around then where the kids got killed. I saw Selma. I watched that movie. It begins with the bombing, but I can't remember the exact dating of that. Maybe if you're looking it up right now, you can see it faster than me. So so Lawler is he sets the Gandhi thing up, and that's what inspires Martin Luther King to be a Gandhiite?
No. Dr. King was learning, and he was, wouldn't he go to a George Washington University or something? He was already in his, he was already doing his thing. He was well in his own system. I'm just saying that as far as organizing the body of people that would actually, get that thing started, that was Jim Lawler.
Okay. And how do you know this story?
Because, you know, I did so much, you know, study of racism when I was doing ministry, trying to wrestle for I was looking for the ground of it, not really understanding what was the hidden ground. I mean, they go all the way back to what's his face, the guy who started all the slave stuff. I can't remember the names now, in England that was over in Africa and the guy who fought it and all the rest of this. I mean, I went all the way back trying to find the hidden ground of it and how it actually came to be so prevalent and what were the solutions of it.
Is this when you were in the ghetto of Indianapolis?
Yeah. So I was very much into that, and so I did all kinds of research and, you know, just like I said, went into the deep waters of it, trying to discover, you know, my own culpability in it, as, many people will say, people who promote race discussions on racism, every white American is automatically racist because they're the privileged society, even though they may not recognize that. And then, you know, going through the whole, like I said, forensic inspection of how it all occurred and stuff. So I read and read and did all kinds of research, and I learned about Dr. Lawler then.
So you bring this up to remind me what?
I bring it up to remind you that it is important for you, if you are going to lead the youth, you must have an economic plan. That is what they are after.
Well, I'm sure I don't.
You know. That is important for the young.
Yeah, I'm holding it close to my vest. I'm not giving my cards out yet. I saw what happened to Castro. I'm not making the same mistakes. I'm going to be even more mysterious than Obama.
Right.
They won't even know I'm running or leading. Could be.
Dear.
Might be.
I didn't think that the thing that shocked me the most about uncovering the racism thing was I did not realize that the intention of, although it should have been a duh, I mean, now that I look back on it, I'm like, a duh, I didn't realize the intention of the whole race movement was to create economic parity among blacks and whites. I mean, the crux of the issue is economic parity. That's all that this thing is driving. What's driving it is the money scene. I thought it was about, you know, loving your brother and the whole hand-holding thing and going up the mountain. And, well, they're all going up the mountain to cash a paycheck. I mean, I didn't understand what it was about until I really got into it and then saw that that's really what the outcomes were all geared toward was economic parity. And that's why the movement fell apart when Dr. King died, because there was no way, none of those people could actually continue to push forward an economic agenda, because Kennedy was killed, King was killed, and the whole thing was squashed. And that's what they needed, was an economic agenda. That's what they wanted.
And Martin Luther King had one.
And Martin Luther King had the beginnings of one as far as articulating that the black and white thing and the going up the mountain and I have a dream and the unity was all built around economic parity. And he could catalyze that for the black people in their hearts and create a vision for them. And then he could say it in a way to the white people that wasn't so offensive. And that was what after he could hold that inside of himself and say those words and catalyze people. After he died, everybody else, and plus Kennedy, everybody else was just bam, bada bing, gone.
What do you think of that a black caucus member, what's his name? Bert, what do you think of that, Bert? What's he saying? Does this sound familiar?
Yes. There are a lot of different strings that can be tied to that main point that Jenny brought through as far as Dr. King's message. There's a lot of other things that go alongside of that, like the current leaders that are supposedly in charge or helping black people, like Jesse Jackson. There's some questionable circumstances of his involvement with Dr. King. But that's the main, what Jenny said is the main point, but there are a lot of other things up to this point that, you know, kind of the whole message or the mission is went by the wayside. I mean, that's what makes I&M Dobbstown interesting, because it's a level playing field where everybody gets to think for themselves and not really follow something that's really not even applicable.
Yeah, we're like Al Qaeda, man. We let the cells decide what they want to do.
Let the cells decide, that's right.
then,
amen
then
to that.
Well, Bob, where are your cells? What cells? Oh, you know, chromosome 14 cells in your body. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about political cells. I'm talking about free. The cells want to be free.
That's right. They want to be fully empowered to do their own thing. They want to be perfect.
Yeah.
They want to be have 144,000 helix strands, even if it means you're going to be a blue iguana. They don't care.
Yeah,
let the cells be free.
They want this covalent bonding. They're for ionic bonding.
That's right.
I know the language. What's your economic program? Well, covalent bonding was okay in the 20th century, but we're more into ionic bonding now.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. That's
never been said before. That's a new joke that's never been said before.
That's a good one, Bob. I like that.
Yeah,
that's right. That's my economic plan.
You cannot have ionic bonding unless you have a new energy system, Coldplay. You got to have Coldplay. You just fall back on covalent left, right, blue, red state dichotomy. It doesn't work. Electron versus neutron. Fuck it. We're going all the way to ionic bonding, a new level. The transparency, a diaphanous audibility, diaphanous visually. Just check page 44 of James Joyce's Ulysses. It's all there.
Very good. Now, that's a platform you can run on, Bob. I think you ought to renew your campaign for president right there.
No, it's always going. It's always happening. We don't even know which country we're running presidency for.
And no doubt.
Who offers the best possibility when we get the cold fusion going?
That's right.
Yeah. When we announce the cold fusion, Bob goes with it. Whatever country picks it up, then Bob's going to be a president. So check him out. The package deal.
There you go.
And also, we got Dr. Deeb. She ain't bad. She's a good looker. You know, she can help your health. So.
That's right.
You got a whole.
That's right.
You got the first family. The first family.
Very good. Oh my gosh, how hilarious.
Yes, our kids will be the first foster kid. First foster kid, second foster kid. I mean, what do they call? Did they call Chelsea first daughter?
No, first family. It's a first family.
They don't
family.
Say first daughter.
Mm-mm. No, just first family.
Okay, well, let's see. Have we listened to much, Lewis? What's it feel like? We could do. Let's just get into this other stuff. This is a chapter called "All That Is Not Race in This World Is Dross," and yeah, I'm talking 10 pages. Anybody ready? Can you handle some more? Anybody? Can you handle more Wyndham Lewis?
Sure, why not?
Sure.
I don't know what Ed does. I've never listened to what he puts up there. Is he going to delete this whole Martin Luther King thing, or is it going to be part of the Wyndham Lewis section? Please.
No, it'll be.
It.
I think it'll be part of it.
Okay.
I don't know what Ed does either. Yeah, it should be all right.
Okay, we're now at page 103 of a book that has, oh, look at that, 202 pages. Look at that beautiful 22 right there, 202. Beautiful. So we're halfway through. It's a strange book, you know. It's old-fashioned kind of hardback and big lettering. There's not that much in each page. It's like basically it's a pamphlet, what we'd have today. Okay, here we go. It has a quote on the first page from Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, page 313. It says, Was nicht Rasse ist auf dieser Welt ist Sprue. Anybody know what that means? You didn't pick up any German, Janine, right?
Say it again, Bob.
No, Bob, I sure
was,
didn't.
Yeah, Was nicht Rasse ist auf dieser Welt. Comma, is Spreu, S-P-R-E-U.
What is race? I'd have to see the words.
Right.
I can't pick them anymore. What is race? Okay. Thoughts?
Okay, I'm muting.
All participants are now muted.
Okay, the first part of all that is not race in this world is gross is something called Blutsgefühl. So Wendell Moose writes, next I suggest that you earnestly grapple with the National Socialist doctrine of the Blutsgefühl. The whole bag of tricks of National Socialist theory is contained in that bloody portmanteau word. I propose that we unpack it here and now and ascertain pronto what the thing contains. And I do not disguise my belief that there is more in it than meets the eye. It is a rather difficult notion for the lackadaisical non-political mind of the Anglo-Saxon to get hold of, but I will do my best to make it pass into that particular intellectual receptacle without tears, and I think I can guarantee to strip it of its for the English or American repellent metaphysical attributes. This dogma of the Blutsgefühl, or the blood feeling, will lead us, for it is implicated with it, into the whole problem of nationalism. So in the next three chapters, we shall perforce transcend the geographical limits of the particular dogmas of National Socialism and find ourselves engaged in a consideration of the general principles that lie behind any such nationalist manifestation as Hitlerism. To start with, I will quote a few lines from a typical article upon this subject. This is from the National Socialist Brief, November 15, 1930. So it's in German, then he gives the translation. National Socialism teaches the age of blood. Out of the blood feeling, a new will to nationalism and to socialism shall be born, out of the conscious blood feeling. The Middle Ages also lived upon the basis of a blood connection between the individual members of the race. Only then the blood connection was not conscious. The ethic of the Middle Ages was Christian. The blood metaphysic was, oh, look at that, the blood metaphysic. Let's just, Ginny, what do you think of that? The blood metaphysic, isn't that summing up the whole book of Revelation or the Bible?
It does.
That phrase?
It does.
Isn't that what you told the Jehovah's Witnesses? It's all about the blood. The blood metaphysic.
It is all about the blood. Yeah.
Isn't this in that world,
that's right. Huh?
Could Bob have done it again, stumbled into the only copy of the Hitler and find out ionic knowledge embedded in the Lewis thing, and that is the reason it's suppressed? Oh. Anyways, the Nazis had their own ion and called Rachel. They were redoing the Nazis. Okay. The blood – well, let's mute Ginny in case she gets carried away. All right. The blood metaphysic was suppressed because of the monkish asceticism, which always operated in a blood-denying sense, since theirs was a world established only upon mind. The body was felt to be a hindrance and denied. Attention to blood peculiarity stamped out as a sin of the flesh. In spite of all these measures against the blood instinct, it is still alive today. National Socialism builds upon this blood feeling. So that's from the pamphlet, November 15, 1930. National Socialism, says Lewis, is founded upon the blood feeling. The Christian asceticism of the Middle Ages, this writer asserts, was always blusverneinend, or blood-denying. He appeals to a more pagan and less metaphysical reality. The instinct of the blood, the bodily poise, color, shape, and smell, that is to be the bond, but a bond based upon similarity, not upon difference. Read that again. The instinct of the blood, the bodily poise, color, shape, and smell, that is to be the bond, but a bond based upon similarity, not upon difference. That profound race sympathy is to be encouraged at all costs. Likewise, the first instinctive revulsion to all that is strange and belonging to a distinct and alien culture must not be suppressed. It must be enthusiastically admitted to our consciousness and entertained. National Socialism builds upon this blood feeling, what Walt Whitman termed, quote, the talk of the turning eyeballs, unquote. It is that you are required to understand. But whereas Walt Whitman, with his cosmic enthusiasms, his bursting and blatant romanticism, his lyrical cult of a universal brotherhood, sought to enlist this sort of fleshly second sight in the service of diffusion, the present-day Blutsgefühl doctrinaires invoke it on behalf of a greater concentration. For the American 19th century prophet, that's Whitman, would have it employed to decipher the talk of the turning eyeballs in the heads of whatever man they revolved, provided he went upright and were certified a human being. I'll do that again. For the American 19th century prophet would have it employed to decipher the talk of the turning eyeballs in the heads of whatever man they revolved, provided he went upright and were certified a human being. But these newer Germanic blood mystics invoked the human body to an end opposite to that of the great revolutionary sentimentalist and romantic, who had himself photographed for preference nude and had called himself Walt and invited everybody else to do so. What the doctrine of the Blitzkopf aims at, as set down above in the passage quoted, is this. It desires a closer and closer drawing together of the people of one race and culture by means of bodily attraction. It must be a true bodily solidarity, identical rhythms in the arteries and muscles and in the effective neural instrument. That should provide us with a passionate exclusiveness, with a homogeneous social framework within the brotherly bounds of which we could live secure from alien interference, and so proceed with our work and with our pleasures, whatever they may be. That is the big idea. Now, back, I just want to check a sentence, back a page. Likewise, the first instinctive revulsion to all that is strange and belonging to a distinct and alien culture must not be suppressed. It must be enthusiastically admitted to our consciousness and entertained. Before that, that profound race sympathy is to be encouraged at all costs. Likewise, the first instinctive revulsion to all that is strange and belonging to a distinct and alien culture must not be suppressed. Okay, it must be enthusiastically admitted to our consciousness and entertained. All right, back to that is the big idea. Dam braces, bless relaxes. Dam braces, bless relaxes, shouted William Blake, who in many ways resembled Walt. The naked figures of Mr. and Mrs. Blake squatting in their suburban conservatory among the flower pots, playing at being Adam and Eve before the fall, taken straight out of the Puritan Bible, match very well the rhetorical nudity of Walt, genitals well to the fore in true patriarchal fashion. In the Atlantic surf, so talking about Walt, match very well the rhetorical nudity of Walt, his genitals well to the fore in true patriarchal fashion, in the Atlantic surf, upon the distant shores of the New World, the new Anglo-Saxony at that time. But romantic cosmos fans like Walt and Blake, and D.H. Lawrence was a tardy, degenerate exemplar of this boisterous breed, are not only out of date in the merely fashionable sense, they are also out of date in the profoundest sense that they are absolutely malapropos. Historically today, they are on all sides confuted. Such a world as the present one could never spontaneously produce them, and it could have no possible use for them. And it is even, for all our sakes, as the stupid of us must at last discover, it is even, for all our sakes, a pity that such a type of person ever existed. For such promiscuous and expansive mystics with their super-emotional appeals prepared the way for the disintegration of our Western society. That society was a poor thing, but our own, and we surely would have improved it if we had only known how to keep it intact. Who at all events can deny that there is a great deal of political apropos and sagacity in the doctrine of these German nationalist leaders? It is their plan to draw in and to concentrate rather than to diffuse, disperse, and mix. It is extremely easy to be facetious with regard to their pure Germanism. That's in quotes. Aryan is a useful word. It conveys something that is well defined enough, for me at all events, but is ethnologically indefensible, I dare say. And I do not pretend myself to regard many of their dogmas in detail as acceptable. Still, there is very much another side to this humanitarian superior scorn about race. And the Anglo-Saxon should not be too complacent, perhaps, about the entire absence in himself of any feeling that could be described as racial. I am persuaded that the opposite, the diffusionist racial ola podrida camp, is equally, if not more, easy to ridicule. And personally, I advocate a great deal of such ridicule. I think it will have a good effect. You cannot laugh enough, it seems to me, at such a literary prophet as D.H. Lawrence, with his fetish of promiscuity and hysterical paeans to all that is dark and strange. So by developing, rather than relaxing, as happens in the cosmopolitan West, the love and understanding of blood brothers, of one culture, children of the same tradition, whose deepest social interests, when all is said and done, are one, that is the only sane and realistic policy in the midst of a disintegrating world. That, as I interpret it, is the National Socialist doctrine of the Blitzkopf. I have described above that expansive romanticism after the manner of Whitman as being out of date. But there is one date, or time, for the Anglo-Saxon, it seems, and another for Europe. The sun reaches us later, but the intellectual dating is not an affair of clocks. It is difficult to say what it is. It was, at all events, of European time that I spoke. Is it not true, if you are disposed to doubt what I have just said, that the English or American undergraduate, and a plus forte raison, the workmen and their native industrial chiefs, are ignorant of any but those too far, too oversimple alternatives, namely an unadulterated Toryism upon the one hand and an unadulterated communism upon the other? So the question was, is it not true that the English or American undergraduate are ignorant of any but those too far, too oversimple alternatives, namely an unadulterated Toryism upon the one hand and an unadulterated communism upon the other? If an Anglo-Saxony, that's A-N-G-L-O hyphen S-A-X-O-N-Y, if in Anglo-Saxony an undergraduate would be very bright and advanced politically, he speaks in cordial terms of Moscow and the Russians, or if he is really a proper devil, he simply joins the Communist Party. If, on the other hand, he inclines to say, quote, I am old-fashioned perhaps, but, etc., unquote, then there is nothing for him but an old crusted Toryism. There is nothing outside these two. There is nothing outside, or maybe it's there is no thing outside these two far too oversimple things. There is no thing outside these two far too oversimple things. The enlightened mind of Anglo-Saxony simply does not function anywhere between or outside those two fixed conventional landmarks. And that is as good as to say, of course, seeing all we have seen in one direction and another since 1914, does not function at all. The enlightened mind of Anglo-Saxony simply does not function anywhere between or outside those two fixed conventional landmarks. And that is as good as to say, of course, seeing that we all have seen in one direction or another since 1914, that it does not function at all. Is beyond question the idlest, most stationary, out-of-date mental machine in the world today. And the young American undergraduate who looks for guidance to Mr. Kirstein and listens to his veiledly communizing and listens to his veiledly communizing tally-ho is no better than that young England who, in Cambridge, suffers Mr. Bronowski to be its guide, philosopher, and friend. Let's see, a few more pages. So how extremely the opposite such a doctrine as I have been outlining above is to all that we are accustomed to in the Anglo-Saxon, the pure Western world, I scarcely need to point out. Reading that again. So how extremely the opposite such a doctrine as I have been outlining above is to all that we are accustomed to in the Anglo-Saxon, the pure Western world, I scarcely need to point out. Here we are, all of us, in one shape or another, exoticists. That's italicized. The exotic. Exoticists. The only thing that has any advertising value is what is different to what we are, what is strange. And so, here enters the social snobbery, amusing. For we are all very much our little gentleman, and would go into fits of giggles or discreet ha-has at that German seriousness, oh yes, which looks behind the conventional political facades and rummages at the foundations of all political doctrines. But in England especially we have suffered for a century from a perfect frenzy of exoticism. We have tasted, breathed, and thought the exotic, and it has been a drug with the stupid intoxication of its perfume that has at last thoroughly enervated our minds. With the early 19th century romantics, the children of Rousseauism and the French Revolution, every refinement of exoticism came into vogue. All the celebrated English poets of that time, the Byrons and Shelleys, were both noisy, picturesque, and empty humanitarian revolutionaries in quotes, and at the same time, worshippers of the strange in quotes. The great French poets of the 19th century were the same. Charles Baudelaire made a point of having an enormous mulatto mistress. Rambo went to Africa to live. Later on, the romantic painter Gauguin went to the South Seas and enjoyed a very great vogue with his rather sugary fakes of the pictorial art of Polynesia. Gauguin enjoyed a very great vogue with his rather sugary fakes of the pictorial art of Polynesia. Today, Paul Gauguin is totally discredited as an artist. I pity anybody attempting to auction a Gauguin picture at the present time. It is very unlikely that there will be any swing of the pendulum either in favor of such pictures. Indeed, all that description of exotic geographical romanticism is eclipsed as far as the world of serious criticism or of the most serious art is concerned. It has died a violent death at the hands of the new men that the dramatic times we live in have rapidly bred up. It survives only in such superficial bookstall literature as that of Paul Morand, his books Buddha Vivant, Maggie Noir, etc. This, I think, we may all agree is an extremely good thing. I say we may agree, but do we in fact agree? For do we act upon our newer and profounder critical values? Do we not rather just affect those values in order to be up to date and then stagnate? The heavily scented old exoticism lingers still among the moneyed amateur art students, of course. There are always a few rich that be the trust fund babies. The heavily scented old exoticism lingers still among the moneyed amateur art students, of course. There are always a few rich, highbrow tourists and super studio tenants, big game hunters, film stars, executant musicians, and American society women who wish to demonstrate how staggeringly original they can be. In brackets, how broad-minded and unbabbity. Unquote, or end of bracket. The latter do still in the province of New York, I believe, oh horror of horrors, go to bed with a Negro, who it is to be hoped, stout fellow, laughs at them with a hyena whoop of hysterical black laughter from time to time up his sleeve. There is too, of course, still the D.H. Lawrence vogue. It languishes, but it lives on. And Lawrence was chock full of a most enraged exoticism. It dripped in aromatic drops from his pages. When he painted pictures in oils, he produced, as one might have expected, a quantity of inferior Gauguins. But the exotic sense, which is at the very heart of the romantic temper, is in a moribund condition today beyond question. He's saying the exotic sense, which is at the very heart of the romantic temper, is in a moribund condition today beyond question. In connection with the doctrine of the blue scaffold, it would be very useful, I think, if we subjected the exotic sense to a brief analysis. The romantic, luxurious sensationalism that caused Charles Baudelaire to acquire a mulatto mistress and then enables the theatrical, music, and other impresarios to put over all that Negro stuff that literally swamps America at this minute deserves far more attention than I can give it here. Let's do that again. The romantic, luxurious sensationalism that caused Charles Baudelaire to acquire a mulatto mistress and that enables the theatrical, musical, and other impresarios to put over all the Negro stuff that literally swamps America at this minute deserves far more attention than I can give it here. That sensationalism. In my next chapter, I will, however, supply an analysis that may be some slight corrective to the usual sentimental opiate.
All participants are now unmuted.
What do you think? Hard to follow?
That was thick for me, Bob.
Right, it's something you're going to read the sentences over again. Got to look at it. But he's saying something. The left and the right are obsolete. So let's see what it's going to be like when he tries to define the new. Just say here. No, it's quite long. Okay, so have we done enough of Wyndham Lewis? Didn't sound too evil to me.
No, that's what I was thinking when you finished this part. That doesn't seem like. I don't see the reason why he was banned. I mean, unless the last part of the book is stating something extreme, but
no. Well, I think any I think any work that challenged anybody's thinking, precept, or concept of anything that had to do with black and white racism at that time was going to be banned.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to have to think about it or be intellectual about it or contemplate it or review it. I mean, now, you know, we can look back on it 100 years later and say, okay, that's pretty tame. But at the time, I can see where people would be very threatened by it. And, you know, European and white societies to this day do not like to have to confront their own mindsets around racism. Mm. So I could see why it would be banned.
It's too smart. It's ahead of its time.
Yeah, it's way too smart. You know, it's giving, you know, it's just way too smart on a lot of different levels. So, yeah, I can see that. I mean, when you have a any group of people group that's predominantly, preoccupied with survival, they're not going to be able to deal with these intellectual ideas and do any kind of thorough self-examination. I mean, that's the one good thing to ION's credit is they instantly, you know, hopefully mostly, if people will allow it, lift the burden of survival off of the individual so that they can actually go beyond that. Otherwise, they're going to continue to peter around at the bottom of Maslow's period, trying to grovel around in the dirt for food, water, and, you know, electricity. So I think that, this I can see where it would be banned, definitely.
So what I didn't get that last thought. You're saying something intellectual, they haven't got time for that. They're trying to survive. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And they don't want anything that's going to threaten. When you're talking about any kind of equity of any level, whether it's social equity, which is mostly what he was talking about, and intellectual equity, I mean, Dr. King was definitely talking about economic equity. That means that the meager little amount that I have is going to have to be, some of it's going to have to be given away to you because I don't have the mind to understand how it could actually do go different. I don't have a both-end conversation, as you said, Bob, in the covalent red, blue, black, white, polarized world. And so people in a polarized position around their own survival, having to consider anybody other than my four and no more, I personally believe after my study in human behavior and watching how people interact at every level of society, I mean, it doesn't matter if they're, you know, down at the bottom of the economic ladder or at the top. When you talk about breaking off a chunk of my stuff to hand it to you for no particular reason, I'm not interested in that if I'm trying to survive.
Mm. Yeah.